All right, we'd be happy to hear argument in Rivers versus Wachovia Corporation. I'm going to ask Mr. Freeman to step forward, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning to the court. Ian Freeman here on behalf of Appellant John Rivers. I'd first like to submit that the district court erred in dismissing Appellant Rivers' claims on derivative grounds, and I advise that Judge Duffy's order should be reversed, and I'm going to succinctly try to tell you four reasons why. One, Judge Duffy overlooked Appellant Rivers' intent to sell his stock, his Wachovia stock, in early 2007. That intent to sell is critical here because he suffered distinct reliance damages that were peculiar to him at the moment the defendants misrepresented Wachovia's financial condition to him, and he forewent a intended bargain for sale that he had was committed to. His intent to sell is supported by the fact that he did indeed sell some stock in early 2007. He just didn't sell all that he had planned to. The cases that the district court erroneously relied upon, Smith v. Waste Management, Manzo v. Rite Aid, and Kagan v. Edison, all involve shareholders who never had such specific intent to sell their stock. Therefore, they were just merely seeing the case in hindsight and seeing their loss of value in hindsight. Those are derivative claims here where Rivers forwent a measured sale at a measured price that he intended. His loss is individual. Second,
they would, of course, be shared by anyone else who might have been induced to sell had they known what you now contend is the true state of affairs.
If those shareholders also had the specific intent and plan to sell like Mr. Rivers did in and around that time, that would be true, Your Honor.
Well, then, by your own explanation, it's not individualized.
Well, it is.
It would be common to anyone with such intent.
The intent to sell that they could prove, and they would have to prove their specific intent and other actions that backed up that intent. But yes, that's not...
These holder suits, as we call them, are virtually limitless. I mean, any shareholder can come forward at any time once the price of the shares has gone down and say, I intended to sell way back when, and I didn't because of some statement. And it's sort of trying to eliminate all the risk in investing.
Well, they would have to come forward with a specific proof to a jury to demonstrate their intent and their reliance.
The problems of proof are all the difficult in these situations. I mean, you have to look into the recesses of a particular individual's mind in January of 2007, it's difficult to say the least to find out what someone is thinking or might be thinking at some particular point in time.
What neither South Carolina law nor North Carolina law has ever barred somebody from bringing a suit for fraud where they allege that they were induced to refrain from acting versus acting. It's well recognized under the laws of both states that inducing somebody to not act is wrongful. And
what we're talking here is as a particular type of suit, which is really a shareholder risk, because I've looked at the record, and I think Judge Duncan's question was pertinent. There's no distinction, is there, between him and every other Wachovia shareholder?
Well, not every other Wachovia shareholder has brought suit under these allegations alleging that they had such intent. Mr. Rivers has.
Well, but everybody could say that. We all look back in hindsight and wish we'd sold at the top of the market and bought at the bottom.
They would have to come forward with specific proof of their intent, and we believe that Mr. Rivers has alleged that intent sufficiently, and indeed...
All you'd have to go on is his say-so.
Well, that would be for the jury to determine.
But you don't even have to get that far, from my perspective, or for purposes of my question. It really doesn't matter. What matters is that there's a kind of internal inconsistency in your proffer, that his injuries are unique and individual, but there could be any number of other people. There are potentially limitless number of people who could suffer the same injury that they could bring forward and prove. That doesn't... That's a non sequitur.
At different times, based on maybe different representations, certainly not all Waco shareholders were listening to the exact same conference calls Mr. Rivers was listening to. Not all Wachovia shareholders read the same materials and reports.
But the harm would be that they didn't sell, that they didn't have an opportunity to sell at the top of the market either.
If they alleged and came forward with the specific intent and proof of that intent.
Like everyone else, like Mr. Rivers and anyone else in that situation.
Well, I would submit to the court that the majority of state courts around the country that have applied their own state law and considered whether or not a shareholder who was fraudulently induced not to sell their stock has determined that those claims are actionable as fraud and negligent misrepresentation.
But that's a different point.
And that the intent that you're talking about is subject to the jury's determination and subject to proof. And now keep in mind, this is at the Rule 12b-6 motion to dismiss pleading stage. The pleadings are to be taken as true.
Your response does go to a different point, and I stopped you when you were on reason number one of your four reasons.
Reason number two is Rivers has suffered because of this intent and him being induced to forbear from selling his securities as he intended. He has suffered a special injury that is distinct from the corporation.
His injury is derivative of the injury sustained by the corporation.
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Rivers' injuries was induced by the misrepresentations of the defendant. The misrepresentations of the appellees, they didn't injure the corporation. They injured Mr. Rivers. To the extent there was any injury to the corporation, that occurred vis-a-vis the mismanagement of the corporation by the appellees. We're not suing for mismanagement. Any misrepresentations of the defendant, didn't cause the price of Wachovia stock to go down. The appellees foisted those misrepresentations upon Mr. Rivers.
Caused it to go up.
They foisted those misrepresentations because they had a pecuniary interest in trying to keep the stock value stable. And ultimately, those misrepresentations convinced Mr. Rivers not to sell as he had planned in early 2007.
But there are a number of difficulties with this. And that is, I still find it very difficult to differentiate his injuries from that suffered by any person who, in the fall of 2008, when Wachovia stock just plummeted over 2008. And so everybody looks back in hindsight and says, gee, I wish I'd sold in 2007 when Wachovia stock was riding high. Now, any shareholder across this country is probably in the fall of 2008 holding stock that diminished dramatically in value from early 2007 because the country went through a significant market fall throughout 2008. And if we give the green light to your suit, just imagine the countless number of shareholders who scratch their heads and say, hey, I'm in exactly this situation. I wish I sold in 2007 too. And, you know, a lot of times people exaggerate Ludgate's argument, but it seems, with all respect, that it's very difficult to exaggerate the floodgates that this particular cause of action.
Your Honor, the point that you're making there, too, is analogous to the Smith, the Manzo, and the Kagan cases, where the plaintiffs just, in hindsight, wished. Here, we have express allegations that Rivers intended to sell, had a plan to sell, and in fact, did sell. And those allegations make this different than the cases that you, the hypotheticals that you just threw out there.
No,
and I think where you, and the court could determine.
He held on to his shares.
Pardon?
He held on to his shares.
He sold some of his shares.
He's making the complaint with his damages would flow from his decision not to sell others.
That's correct. The damages would flow from that. However, the damages relate to the specific, the claim relates to the specific misrepresentations he heard at that time that induced him not to do so. Not from
any contractual relationship between Mr. Rivers and the corporation?
No, Your Honor, just the relationship of him as a shareholder.
So it's just the only relationship here is he's not an employee, he's not in a contractual relationship, it's just the relationship of a shareholder to the company?
That's correct, Your Honor. If I could move on also, point number three. The individual appellees are former officers of Wachovia, and they were also shareholders. They had, as I discussed a moment ago, a pecuniary interest in having Rivers retain his stock. And the misrepresentations that were directed at him, did induce him not to sell. And because they had this pecuniary interest, a duty flowed to Mr. Rivers to tell the truth. And I believe that he alleges facts that give rise to both a breach of fiduciary duty and a special duty that also satisfy the Barger exceptions and the Brown exceptions, allowing a direct action under these circumstances. I'd also add that North Carolina and South Carolina courts recognize that fraudulently induced inaction give rise to a claim for fraud. There's no heightened pleading requirements under South or North Carolina law. And as I also said, courts around the country have recognized that these types of holders' claims are valid, viable, and may be brought in a direct action where plaintiffs such as akin to Mr. Rivers have alleged the specific factual underpinnings of their intent to sell.
You keep talking about fraudulent inducement of inaction, but so many of those claims are in a very different factual context from a shareholder suit against a corporation for a decline in the value of stock.
I will concede that several of the cases, Howell.
My thought of it was when you got into a shareholder suit against a corporation for a decline in shareholder in the value of shares, that as Judge Duffy set forth, North Carolina and South Carolina law require some sort of a special relationship between the corporation and the plaintiff, which would differentiate and distinguish his suit from that of other shareholders so that a recovery of one shareholder would not invariably be seen to be as a taking from other share at the expense of other shareholders. I mean, that's what it seemed to me the North Carolina and South Carolina cases say, and you're talking at a very high level of generality. And but when you get into the specific context, it seems to me that some sort of special connection, being whether the person is an employee or whether the person has some sort of contractual relationship and the lawsuit grows out of that rather than just a general decline of share and shareholder in the value of share.
Well, these individual appellee officers have superior knowledge about Wachovia. And they certainly knew in early 2007.
That's what you might know. That's what you might allege in a 10b-5 suit. But, you know, this isn't really a 10b-5 action, and you haven't brought it, is that? You tried to steer clear of 10b-5, because that has the requirement of being in connection with the sale or purchase of a security, and there's no sale or purchase. But the very reasons that you wanted to steer clear of 10b-5, it seems to me you also run into with your state a cause of action, unless some special relationship, which just doesn't appear on this record.
Well, I would also submit that if the court finds there is no special relationship, the special injury exception to the derivative bar is an independent exception. And as I argued earlier, the court can allow the individual action of Appellant Rivers to proceed simply where he has relied to his detriment and been induced by the defendant's misrepresentations, be them fraudulent or negligent misrepresentations, that can be measured from the time when he was induced.
In no way that would not be shared across the class of shareholders.
I believe that his damages aren't shared from across the class of shareholders because not every shareholder suffered the exact same injury at the exact same time he did. Not every shareholder intended to sell. Not every shareholder had a plan to sell their stock in early 2007.
Not every shareholder. The implication of that is, yes, but there were thousands and thousands and thousands who did or were claimed to did.
They're not here before the court, and I don't represent them.
They soon would be, sir.
They would have to come forward, and the court could craft whatever acts and requirements it deemed prudent to reassure itself that it wouldn't be opening the floodgates, and that sufficient proof would be provided.
And you, Mr. Walker, I see here has some rebuttal time.
Yeah.
We will look forward to hearing from you then.
Thank you.
Mr. Fuller, let's hear your side of it.
May it please the court. I think it's clear that the court understands the issues well. So let me see if I can focus on a few points that I think may be helpful. We believe, of course, that Judge Duffy correctly dismissed the claim, holding that it was derivative. And we note that we've submitted an appendix to our brief with three other decisions, two by North Carolina Business Court Judge Jolly and one by the South Carolina Business Court Judge who Judge Duffy relied upon, Judge Young, in four cases that were very, very close to being identical. In each instance, the plaintiff alleged that they had held shares, that they had considered selling them. Actually, in the other cases, there was even more allegation of personal contact. In one of the cases that was actually not appealed, a fellow named Mr. Harris alleged that he had talked to Ken Thompson, the president of Wachovia. In each instance, the lower court dismissed the claim, determining that it was a derivative claim. And the argument that my colleague made really focused on, well, I should have a holder claim and there ought to be some kind of a claim because I was defrauded into holding my shares. The initial analytical question I'd submit that is before the court is, whose claim is it? Because it can't belong to two different people or entities. And the determination of who owns the claim has to be made under North Carolina law. Now, Judge Duffy concluded that we win under either North or South Carolina law, and I agree with that, but I do have some interest in sort of the jurisprudence being consistent. The reason that the issue has to be determined under North Carolina law is that if North Carolina law were to hold that this is a derivative claim and South Carolina law were to hold that it was not, then the defendants could be liable to two different plaintiffs for the same damages. So you could have Mr. Thompson and the others being sued in a derivative claim in North Carolina and have them being sued in a non-derivative claim in South Carolina.
Did Judge Duffy indicate there was any difference between the laws of the two states?
There's not, and so from that perspective, Your Honor, you're not required to reach that issue, but it's a point that we really didn't bring out as well in our brief as I wish we had.
I didn't see any particular difference.
No, sir, there's not. Under either law, you have to show that you have a separate and special injury. If we look at the decision that Business Court Judge Dolly in North Carolina issued in the Harris case, in Harris there were virtually identical allegations that Harris considered selling his shares. Virtually every shareholder who monitors their portfolio considers selling their shares. I mean, you sit down, you look at it, you say, well, should I sell this or should I not sell it? If you could, in 2020 hindsight, be allowed to make an individual claim under these circumstances, Your Honor's observations are correct. The floodgates would be open. The entire paradigm of corporate governance would collapse. And it really wouldn't make any sense. In addition, as we pointed out in our brief, Chief Justice Roberts and a number of other courts have observed that the damage here is not caused by his inability to sell his shares. If the allegations in his complaint were true, which we have to take them as true for these purposes, although for the record we disagree with that. If the allegations in his complaint were true, all he was deprived of was the ability to sell his shares at an inflated price. And that's not a damage that the court should recognize. I believe Chief Justice Roberts said that would be a curious claim for the courts to sanction.
Do we really have to, do you think it's necessary for us to focus on floodgates issues and cosmic considerations such as paradigms of corporate governance? What we have here is a requirement that there be a special relationship or a special injury. And even the formulation of the claim that he was deprived of an opportunity to sell, and not every at a time when he might have preferred to sell because the prices were high, by definition is a claim shared by anyone similarly situated.
That is correct, Your Honor. You do not have to look at this in the more global way that I was addressing it in my argument. Simply applicable.
They're not completely unconnected because the requirement of a special relationship under North Carolina and South Carolina law exists in order to prevent the issue from going global.
That's awesome.
I mean, in a sense, they're valid observations, but in a sense, they're just two different sides of the same coin, isn't it?
That's why
the special relationship requirement is put in there to cabin.
That's exactly correct. Both of your observations are correct. The case could be decided broadly or narrowly, and the same considerations, depending on which angle you look at them, really compel the same result. If you look at the allegations of this complaint, he doesn't say, oh, I talked to so-and-so on such and such a date, and they told me this, so I canceled an order with my broker. He doesn't even say which specific representations he allegedly relied on. It's a laundry list of every 10K and 8K and other public statement that Wachovia Corporation made over a very long period of time.
One of the things that concern me here is simply the practical problem of proof. How do we get at the question of whether someone did or didn't intend to sell in January of 2007? We are almost completely at the mercy of a single affidavit.
That's correct, Your Honor. And to make it clear, North Carolina and South Carolina have never recognized holder claims. Some states have, and I actually have a case in California now that alleges holder claims where they are recognized. This complaint would not survive under the small case in California. It's very difficult to have a holder claim in California, even though they're technically recognized, because there are two major hurdles that the plaintiff has to overcome. One, they have to plead with a very high degree of specificity. You just can't say, I thought about selling and I didn't. You've got to have some objective evidence that takes you outside of that sphere. And secondly,
it's not clear that North Carolina or South Carolina law would recognize a holder claim even if there was the specificity in the absence of a special relationship.
That's correct, Your Honor. They would not. I'm simply illustrating that one of the other problems.
As you describe California law, and I don't really know what a California law is on the point. It sounds very different from North Carolina.
It is. The other problem that the plaintiffs run into in the states that recognize holder claims is they can't show damages because the damages are based on an overinflated price. And that doesn't logically hold water, which gets back to the point I was making before. So I'd submit that really the beginning and end of this case is that it's a derivative claim, and that the analysis of the district court was entirely correct, as was the analysis of two different business court judges.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. And I'm going to ask my colleagues if they have any questions at all of you. We have your brief, and I think we understand your point.
I was getting ready to stop.
We have no further questions.
Thanks,
sir.
Thank you, sir.
But we would like to hear from Mr. Walker.
Good morning. My name is Brennan Walker. I, too, am here on behalf of John Rivers. I've heard it said there are no problems, they're just opportunities. I feel like I've got an opportunity here, having heard the panel's questions. And I want to go back to the basis of the district court ruling. The district court made its ruling by holding that our claim for misrepresentation, now concentrate on misrepresentation claim, was a derivative claim. I would submit to the court that it isn't a derivative claim and it can't be a derivative claim. A derivative claim has to arise from a wrong to the corporation. In this case, the complaint alleges misrepresentations to the plaintiff. The misrepresentations did not injure the corporation. That's part two. Not only is the misrepresentation or are the misrepresentations not wrong to the corporation, but the corporation suffers no loss. The misrepresentations do not cause a loss to the corporation.
No, but the injury suffered by the plaintiff here was the dramatic drop in the share price. And the injury suffered by the corporation, presumably, would be the same thing, which is a dramatic drop in the share price.
Approximately caused by different events. The drop in the share
but
price
that the question in a derivative suit, the question is whether the injury suffered by the individual is derivative of the injury suffered by the corporation.
This injury was not derivative of the injury suffered by the corporation, and here's why, because our client would have sold stock. His loss was caused by losing the benefit of the bargain as a result of the misrepresentation. The corporation's loss was caused by allegedly mismanagement. And if I could give an example of the distinction, if we represented a plaintiff who didn't sell his stock because of certain reasons and the stock went down and he lost the benefit of the bargain because of misrepresentations, he could recover regardless of the cause of loss to the corporation.
Derivative injury or non-derivative injury, we can debate that, but that still doesn't get to the question of whether South Carolina and North Carolina would recognize a holder claimant in the absence of a special relationship. And it still doesn't address the question of whether we were brought up at the very outset of the argument about whether the this individual's injury can be differentiated in any sense from the injury of any other shareholder. So, you know, you and I may or may not share the same understanding of the term derivative, but the question is whether the law of these two states recognize holder claim in the absence of any sort of special relationship, and in the circumstance where one shareholder, like every other shareholder, and there's no distinction or differentiation that can really be drawn.
I would say that there is a distinction. And I would ask the court to consider that there is a distinction. And the distinction is that which has been recognized by several courts, that there was a specific intent to sell. And back to the other part of your question, we realize we have to show a separate and distinct injury in order to prevail. And there is a separate and distinct injury. It's separate and distinct because of the loss of the benefit of the bargain. Given our client's intent to sell, not only did he have intent to sell, but he did sell some shares. I would ask the court.
All sorts of people trim positions, and you know, when it looks like a stock is riding high, you trim the position 20%, so whatever, so you maintain the diversity in your portfolio. But that isn't that isn't anything other than what a prudent investor would normally do.
Well, we would submit that's a question, a factual question to be determined. The court has extreme reservations about letting a jury decide this issue. Juries decide questions of intent every day. The question of intent is inherently factual, and the intent in this case is no less a factual question or beyond the province of jury than the question of intent in any other case. My last point with 3 seconds to go is the blue chip decision by the United States Supreme Court in ruling that 10b-5 would not allow a holder claim specifically said in that opinion that it was not ruling out claims under settled common law principles that could be decided by the states. And so a court, no less the United States Supreme Court, has said that this doesn't present such policy problems that it can't be one governed by state law.
Well, of course, that's what Judge Duffy did. He decided it under state law.
Thank you.
We thank you. We would like to come down and greet counsel, and then we'll take a brief recess.